Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined down the line from the Highlands of Scotland by Julian Treasure, the world-leading speaker on sound and communication skills. Founder of audio solutions firm The Sound Agency, Julian's mission is to help businesses use sound to connect with customers on a deeper emotional level. Julian's TED Talks have been viewed over 150 million times. His How to Speak So That People Will Listen clip is one of the top TED Talks of all time. The author of Audio Branding Bible Sound Business, Julian is passionate about the science of sound and the positive impact that it can have on our lives. Julian, thank you for joining me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Paul.
This is a podcast, but it's also going to be an hour of amazing instruction for me. I'm very, very happy to have you on because I want to learn a lot, selfishly speaking, never mind on behalf of our listeners. I've always wanted to know this. How do you speak then so that people actually want to listen to you?
Well, a lot of it comes down to listening to them, actually. So you have a circular relationship between speaking and listening. Most people think it's a straight line, you know, I speak, you listen. But actually, it's always a circle, because the way I speak affects the way you listen, and the way you listen affects the way I speak, and on. So a lot of it is to do with understanding the dynamics of that circle and the fact that those two things affect one another. Also, incidentally, they're both skills. And it's very interesting, isn't it, that we teach in school reading and writing, two ways, very important ways to communicate, but we do not teach speaking or listening, which to me is bizarre, because we've been using language to communicate for well over 100,000 years, possibly 200,000 years. Writing only came along about 5,000 years ago, and yet it's taken over. You know, written communication is the norm now, text, email, and so forth. So we're deploying our fingers and our eyes to communicate the whole time. We become hugely visual. And yet, speaking and listening are so vital. They're so visceral. They're so impactful. And they're skills which we can develop, we can learn, we can perfect, we can become masters of. And yet most people just take what they're given and think these things are the same as, you know, hearing, which is a capability. Listening is a skill. And in the same way, using this amazing instrument we all play, the human voice, well, that's a skill. You wouldn't walk on stage at the Albert Hall with no training whatsoever. And just like, it amazes me. You know, I do talks to thousands of CEOs around the world about these skills. And I will say, how many of you use your voice in your work? Just like you do, Paul, or I do. And the forest of hands will go up. They'll all say, yes, I use my voice. I present. I stand in front of teams. I do platform presentations. I speak to the media. Okay. How many of you have had formal vocal training? A handful. I just think, what's going on? If your voice is so important to you, train it. Become a master of it. So there's a few answers to your question there, Paul. Sorry to rabbit on for a while there. I'm very passionate about this, as you can tell.
You weren't rabbiting on. That was absolutely fascinating. And I do listen to my podcast guests anyway, but I made a special effort to listen to you then because I don't want to not listen on a podcast about the importance of listening. And of course, as a direct result of that, several other questions spring to mind. I mean, you talked then about the, frankly, the underinvestment in our young people, that they're not taught how to listen at school. Is it also got worse? We live in an ever noisier world. You know, have people forgotten what little listening skills they were given, you know, when they were young?
There's a lot of forces acting against being a good listener these days. Yes, the world is getting noisier all the time. Population grows. And despite a little hiatus, it was possibly the only benefit of the hideous experience of the COVID pandemic was that the world suddenly became much quieter and a lot of people rediscovered the joy of serenity, quietness, solitude, peace, whatever you want to call it, tranquility. Well, it's all resumed. Jet travel has resumed, traffic noise has resumed, construction, social gatherings, you know, all that noise has come back again. And it does get noisier every year. The more of us there are, the more densely packed we are. But also there are so many other things that are pushing against our ability to spend time and listen. That's the pace of life. I mean, technology has got a lot to do with it. Nobody can stop technology. It's kind of bigger than humanity. Nobody's going to stand there and say, whoa, 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 hold on a minute. Let's just have a year where we think about this. Nope. AI is coming. You know, we've all got devices in our hands. I love, I don't know if you've read the book, Indistractable by Nir Eyal. I think that's a terrific book about...
We've had Nir on the podcast. He was fascinating.
Excellent. Well, you know, this is the world we live in. We are distracted the whole time. How many people listening to this sit in bed doing email late at night instead of talking to their partner or being with people? I mean, how many of us sit around a dinner table or a lunch table, all of us with devices in our hands, looking down, not speaking to anybody? So again, there's a terrific TED talk about this called Alone Together. Shelley Turkle, I met her at TED, and she's a professor at MIT whose thesis is that technology is not creating this wonderful global village where we're all closer together. It's replacing a few deep relationships with a large number of very shallow ones and really dividing us, moving us apart instead of together in many ways. You only have to look at the power of email, which I'm sure everybody listening to this has a love-hate relationship with. And I don't know how many emails you get. I mean, you were talking earlier about you've got a team of people who can help you with email, which is a wonderful thing, but many of us don't. And, you know, I get hundreds of emails a day, and I've got wonderful systems arbitraging them and organizing them, so I should only see the ones that are really important. Nevertheless, I think there are many people around the world whose job description could be actually two words: answer email. I mean, that's what many people do a lot of the day with those pinging noises. And by the way, that's a great tip for anybody who has email fatigue. Do not have an alert every time an email comes in. Do it a couple of times a day, you know, half an hour before lunch, half an hour before the end of the day, whatever it is, and keep the rest of your time sacrosanct. So I think these distractions, they put us into a sort of frenzy. FOMO is at the heart of it, really. The fear of missing out on something. You know, something going on. I have to be paying attention to all these things all the time, especially with social media. And of course, what happens? Well, we don't listen to the people we're with. Scott Peck, the American author, and who I really
The Road Less Traveled.
The Road Less Traveled, one of the great books. Which is essential reading for everybody in the modern world. He said, you cannot truly listen to another human being and do anything else at the same time. I absolutely agree with that. And yet, how much of our lives do we spend sort of faux listening, partially listening?
Yeah,
I am listening. No, you're looking down and tapping on a keyboard. That's not listening. That's doing something else. So,
isn't it bizarre we spread ourselves so thinly? I mean, you talk there about like relationships as well. I mean, there was the British anthropologist Robin Dunbar, wasn't he? Came up with Dunbar's number, which I think was about 150. And that's because of our brain size. That's the maximum number of people like in our community that we can deal with. And any more than that, we start to dilute our effectiveness at life and our ability to maintain relationships. I agree with you. Everyone's so frightened of missing out, are they not? That they that they want to just sort of pay shallow attention to greater numbers of things.
Yes, I mean, having 5,000 friends on Facebook, are they really friends? I think we've redefined the word a little bit there, haven't we? And as you say, really, it's a question of the close relationships. I mean, all the surveys I've seen show that happiness is very much about social connection and about service. Those two things, not fame, not money, not kudos. None of those things really bring happiness. There are lots of very sad and miserable rich people or famous people. But doing service and being part of a community, those things do matter. And they rely very much on communication, on listening to other people, connecting with other people. And to me, the skills of speaking and listening, they're fundamental at home, in our home relationships. I mean, what's the most frequent complaint in relationships? He or she never listens to me. And they're also crucial in business. How can you lead people if you don't understand them? And listening is the doorway always to understanding. Conscious listening is the doorway to understanding. And how can you inspire people if you don't know how to connect with them? You know, there's something I teach, which is a really important point about speaking, which is that you always speak into a listening. You always speak into a listening, whether it's one person or a thousand. It's a listening that's there. And it's always different, because every human being listens in a unique way. Our listening is as different as our fingerprints, our voice print, our irises. It's unique, because you and I listen through a set of filters, and we've come a different road to this conversation here today. So along the way, you know, we're born into a culture, which might be the street, the town, the family, the tribe, whatever it is. We learn to speak a language, which in our case is the same language, but it isn't always. And even dialects can be very, very different semantically. And then along the way, we gather values, attitudes, beliefs from parents, from friends, from role models. We pick some things up, we discard others. And then in any given situation, we might have an intention. We might have expectations. We might have emotions going on. We might have assumptions about, particularly about what's going on in other people's heads. All of these things color our listening in the here and now. So our listening changes through the day, and the listening changes from person to person. So any group of people in a particular place at a particular time has a unique listening. And if we can just start asking the question, what's the listening I'm speaking into right now? Then that is a big part of the secret of hitting the bullseye instead of missing the target altogether.
Is the problem worse than you surmise, though? Because people are on broadcast mode these days. They're shouting into the void on social media. PR people like me are all about this sort of the attraction, the engendering of attention. We live in an attention economy, and it seems to be very supply side centric rather than, as you rightly say, people should listen more, but they're not. What's to be done?
Yeah, well, we are highly ocular and also highly send oriented. It's quite interesting. My TED talk about speaking has got five times as many views as my TED talk about listening. And that parallels the research that's been done in organizations. There was a big piece of research done a few years ago called the Organizational Listening Project. And they found that organizations were putting at least five times as much effort into sending as they were into receiving or listening in any way, shape or form. You know, you say corporate communication, what do you think of immediately? Advertising, PR, social media, it's all outbound. Very little of it is inbound. Listening is, you know, it's a skill that's often recruited on. People will put it into recruitment ads, good listener and so forth. But the moment they take somebody on, it disappears. There's not many organizations who have it in their 360 review. You know, is this person a good listener? Who reward good listening with bonuses or promotions? It doesn't really happen that much. And we do have a culture that's very orientated around being shouty. I mean, anybody who's seen Susan Cain's wonderful TED talk about introverts will know that there's a huge portion of the population who've got so much to offer, and they're just quiet people. And they often get overlooked because we think the people who are strident and loud and bombastic are more confident and have got more to offer. That's not the case. It's just a style thing. So I do think we need to relearn really the art of listening. It used to be much more important than it is now. Once upon a time, it was crucial for survival. You know, if you were a few hundred thousand years ago, if you were entering a cave to spend the night, you'd be listening pretty carefully because there might be a tiger or a bear or snakes or whatever in there. So listening for most species is a matter of survival, and it's a matter of also finding prey, mates. I mean, it's absolutely critical for the success of your species, but not so much now for humanity. Most of the sound around us is noise. A lot of it can be ignored, and indeed we get into the habit of doing that. So I do think it comes down, Paul, probably to education. I would love listening to be taught in schools. And if we can't do it in schools, I'm doing my level best, and thank goodness, you know, the TED Talks are getting good traction. I'm doing my level best to persuade people like the people listening to this podcast that listening is fundamental in achieving your outcomes in life. Absolutely crucial. Take it seriously. It's a skill. Master it, and everything will be easier and more successful.
It's interesting because for me, you've uncovered this, for me, is a symptom of an even deeper problem, because I like to listen to people with whom I agree. Is there a deeper desire in people's subconscious to actually be validated, to feel right rather than feel truly heard, or to understand the other person's point of view?
Yes, I talk about two human desires, habits, failings, which really do get in the way of our communication. Now, one of them is the desire to look good. And that's often behind people, you know, who walk on stage and give a good performance, but there's a shallowness to it. And people can very often detect, you know, this is all about me seeking approval, me looking great, me getting rounds of applause and affirmation. Well, that tends to be something that people can feel, whether it's a public speech or it's, you know, one person talking to another and showing off by being bigger and better and best and all of that kind of stuff. So looking good can really get in the way of true, valuable human communication. And by the way, I mean, I've done hundreds and hundreds of talks, and I can tell anybody who does have to speak on stage, it's not about you. And once you get that, you move into a new realm of being much more powerful as a speaker. It's about the gift you're giving to the other people. So that's one, looking good, watch out for it. And the other one, as you so correctly say, is being right. You know, if there's one thing we like more as human beings than looking good, it's being right. And the American counselor and author Harville Hendricks, for whom I have a lot of time, said, you can either be right or be in a relationship. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know. I mean, we're so wedded to being right, and it creates all these arguments where it becomes bombastic, it becomes table thumping. People get very confused about the difference between opinions and facts, which are two different things. And social media has made that orders of magnitude worse.
It's one of my pet hates that people say, this is my truth, as if it's something subjective.
Yes. Yes, there is truth. I mean, obviously, we have our own identities, we have our own beliefs and so forth, but facts and opinions are two different things. And the social media allowed people now to go out and get validation for almost any crackpot belief. And hence, we've got all these conspiracy theories and silos of groups of people who believe something which is palpably nonsense. But then they go in there and there you are. I knew I was right. Thousands of people agree with me. Well, yeah, but you're not talking to the millions who don't. And if we don't seek opposing views, you know, in the way that science does thesis, antithesis, what you get is synthesis. You move on. You start to appreciate the challenges had some points, and things improve by being challenged generally. If we don't do that, then we are ending up, well, which I think we can all see we are at the moment, in a polarized world, a world where nobody wants to listen to people with whom they disagree. I mean, there's a great quote from Barack Obama. When he was president, he said, I will listen to you, especially if we disagree.
And that he also famously said, we can disagree without being disagreeable.
Yes, yes. Both of which, unfortunately, are very rare things now. So you get, you know, we're on this slippery slope, really, there. And the media are very complicit in this. It's a kind of dance of death between all of us with our desire to be right. And of course, the easiest way for me to be right is to make you wrong, Paul, because that elevates me and it suppresses you and makes me feel better about myself. So we are getting addicted to outrage, to blaming. You know, and that's what a lot of the media are about now. Who's to blame? This is disgraceful. This is outrageous. Somebody must be punished for this. And so we get this cycle of round and round of more and more outrage, more and more conflict, more and more polarization. And politics is becoming almost impossible now, to the point where, I mean, I do understand politicians starting to say, is this really a job I can do? Because there's so much hate involved, trolling, death threats, all the rest of it.
And humiliation of the opposing side as well. Now, it seems to be a badge of honor if you trigger that. I hate that phrase. Someone could argue I'm triggered by it, but like you've triggered the other people. Like if you've upset them, that's a win. Like why are we so, that's just not being very nice as people.
No, unfortunately, there's a great deal of it. Social media does tend to bring out the animal, you know, the sort of pack mentality in people. John Ronson's got a great book about social media shaming and a really, really good little TED Talk, which I do recommend anybody.
I've seen it. It's fab.
Yeah, I was in the room when he did that, and it was a really tingling experience. So I think listening is the antidote to a lot of this, you know. The ability to listen to somebody with whom we disagree. I mean, to me, active listening in a conversation has got two very important elements to it. There are two little stages to go through. The first stage is reflecting what the person said in a calm, dispassionate way. So let me get this right. You're saying this, this, and this. Yeah? Yes. Okay. Then we move on to stage two, the most important stage, which is validation. Well, I don't agree with you, but I can understand why you would think that. Now, that's a different world from just, you idiot, how you, you know, that's nonsense, and all of that kind of dogmatic denial. Because if you invalidate somebody, I'm being right, you're being wrong, all we're going to end up doing is shouting at each other. And that's no way to move forward. Whereas if I can validate you and say, look, I totally disagree with you, Paul, but I do understand why you would think that, then we've got some sort of channel for communication. And we can perhaps work together to come to a synthesis or find a way we can coexist, which is essential for civil society, for democracy to exist. When I gave a talk a few years ago in Athens, at TEDx Athens, the cradle of democracy, where I said, listening is the sound of democracy, because we can only coexist, live next door to people with whom we fundamentally disagree, if we're able to listen to them and validate them in that way and understand them. I don't have to agree, but if there are more of you than there are of me, I have to live by your rules, and that's democracy.
It's a challenge, isn't it? Because societies are more divided than ever. You only have to look at the Brexit debate, where people are really polarized and not listening to each other. I thought the whole of the referendum debate was a complete waste of time. I didn't know anyone on either side of the debate that changed their mind. I have Palestinian friends and Israeli friends. 99% of each of those people want to live in peace and harmony and get on with their lives. And the 0.1% on both sides hijack the debate. And of course, people want to frame it that the Israelis are the aggressors or the Palestinians are terrorists, whereas the reality is they're all human beings and the vast majority of them want to live in peace and harmony and build, you know, a lasting community. It's just odd that 0.1% on either side sort of commands attention and forces people to pick sides, because the reality is that no one of those sides is going to quote-unquote win. They're all human beings and they need to find a way to live together. It sounds almost naive to say it, does it not? But surely that's the only way.
It's also more difficult, messy, painstaking, takes patience, takes kindness, it takes, you know, a will to work with people with whom we disagree. And unfortunately, the world we're in is a world which is fostering impatience and snap decisions and aggression and judgment. And, you know, I often say, I don't think you can love somebody and judge them at the same time. I think it's a one-way street. If you're judging, you're not loving. And we do an awful lot of judging other people now. So that's something to watch out for. I think that tendency to set oneself up as a condemning judge, as one of the seven deadly sins of communication that I talk about in that TED Talk that did so well.
It puts people at more risk as well, because we're much at greater risk in this country of greater risk of violent or acquisitive crime, because we treat our criminals, we send them to prison for quote unquote punishment. We've got to cage them and, you know, be tough on them. Like it's a vengeance oriented mentality. Whereas if you look at the Scandinavian countries, they treat their prisoners with dignity. They teach them to read and write and give them a trade and frankly, give them a reason to have some hope when they're released, which is why they then don't commit crimes. But we're more interested as a society in quote unquote being tough and punishing them than actually our own safety, because I'm much less likely to be a victim of crime on the streets of Oslo than I am in London.
Yes, and obviously even worse in America, where you have that three strike rule. So, you know, steal a loaf of bread and you could be in prison for 10 years.
What a waste of money as well as people's lives.
Yeah, totally. So I think, you know, listening, I'm not saying, you know, there isn't evil in the world. I'm not saying there aren't bad people. I'm not saying everybody's lovely and we just need to be kind. But I think listening, it can be very discerning. It can detect, you know, people for whom, well, it's not good for me to be around those people. I'm going to distance myself, or that person is definitely a bad person. You have to listen in order to pick these things up. But castigating, judging anybody who disagrees with me as an idiot or dismissing them in that way, that's very unfortunate. You know, I talk about people being opportunities to learn. So everybody that you meet actually is an opportunity to learn. It might be that you learn how not to do something. Well, that's very often the case. But if you're listening carefully and attentively, it's amazing how often it is actually that you learn how to do something from somebody that you never would have thought you would have learned anything of. So judging books by covers, that kind of snap dismissal of people is very dangerous. I mean, in speaking, I talk about four foundations for powerful speaking, which I think are really important. The first is, and they spell the word hail, so it's easy to remember. The first is honesty, which is being clear and straight in what you say. And that's something which many organizations need to pay attention to. You know, I've seen some quite funny articles recently in the press about job ads, which are full of the most unbelievable bullshit. They're just endless sequences of meaningless words. We have to be clear and straight in what we say at all times, especially if you're leading people and you want them to be with you. Using big, pompous, jargonistic language is not the way to go. So that's the H. The A, authenticity, being yourself. It's a lot easier actually to be yourself than to pretend to be somebody that you're not. And even if you're an introvert, you have so much to offer. You know, I'm an introvert and I enjoy now standing on stage and speaking in front of lots of people, but it doesn't mean that I speak in the way that perhaps, I don't know, a Tony Robbins or somebody does. You can be introverted and speak beautifully. Look at Ken Robinson, look at Susan Cain. So it doesn't mean you have to change your personality to be effective. The I of hail is integrity, being your word. If you say it, do it. Don't write checks you're not going to cash. It is really important, because if you are somebody who says things and they don't happen, then your words just end up evaporating like puddles in the sun. It's not a way to get powerful speaking across to people.
Well, Emerson said, who you are rings so loudly in my ears, I cannot hear what you say. Because once that bond of trust is broken, then it doesn't matter what you say, does it? You're entirely right.
That's right. We don't listen to people we know are lying or exaggerating or just, you know, not being straight with us. And the L of hail, perhaps surprisingly, love. So that tempers the honesty. I mean, we, you know, honesty is important, but it's not necessary to be brutally honest at all times. I mean, my goodness, you're looking terrible this morning. Well, did I have to say that? Not really. So honesty tempered with love and kindness. And I'm not talking here about romantic love, obviously. It's loving kindness, agape, Christians would call it, simply wishing people well, to be honest. And if you're doing that, that's the secret to, you know, walking on stage and connecting with an audience, actually wishing them well with a smile. They can pick up on it. You get smiles back. And there's a connection which makes everything so much more powerful. So honesty, authenticity, integrity, and love.
How on earth did you get started on this incredible journey? I mean, I know that you had 20 years of experience in advertising and magazine publishing before founding the sound agency. Tell us about audio branding. Tell us about how you got into this and what your journey has been personally, because it sounds to me like it's been a fascinating learning experience for you.
Yeah, I've been very lucky in my career to have been in several kind of organizations which were exploding and at seminal moments in their industries. So, you know, I've had the experience of working in some really exciting places and, yes, started in advertising, Saatchi & Saatchi, Garland Compton back in the early 80s when that company was going through the roof, and then moved on to work in computer magazines just when PCs came along and that industry then exploded. And that was a very exciting place to be. And then, yes, I started my own company in 88. To produce customer magazines, contract magazines. So a brand with a magazine of its brand, talking hopefully about interesting things, which is now called branded content, which would engage the customers and give depth really to the brand and its promise and its delivery. And that was specifically in the computer industry for quite a while until we won Orange in 94 and then Microsoft in America and doubled the company in one day, which was quite an exciting day.
Wow.
So then I ran that until 2002 and sold that to a big American advertising group and then launched the sound agency. Now, why sound? Well, all the way through that career in publishing and in advertising, I'd been a musician. I started playing when I was 12. I'm a drummer and I've been a professional musician for parts of that that journey, and music is incredibly important to me. And I think musicians do listen to the world in a slightly different way to non-musicians. You have to, if you're playing in a band or an orchestra, you have to be listening to everybody else in the group, because if you're not doing that, you're not playing well. And this is a kind of attentive multi-track listening that musicians develop, which I think does mean that they're walking around listening rather more attentively to the world in general. Certainly that was true for me. I'm very auditory. So when I sold my wonderful company, TPD Publishing, which later got changed its name to Just Customer Communication, I sold that to Interpublic, which was sadly not a great experience. And I wanted to do something about sound. And originally I thought, well, let's do something around music because music is used in advertising all the time. And I knew so many musicians who had terrible relationships with advertising agencies who were briefing them, you know, can we have something like the theme from Rambo, but sensitive, you know, and you get this kind of nonsense.
Somewhat
going
conflicting
on.
Instructions there.
Totally, yes. And then they'd change it every 5 seconds. Can you make the beginning a bit more, you know, it was just awful. But I found that was not the place to go because it was a minefield and it was very difficult. So I started reading, researching. I started with the question, does sound matter? Does it affect us? And I found that it very much does. And I created this structure, which the sound agency rests on and still does, the four effects of sound, physiological. Sound changes our bodies. Heart rate, breathing, hormone secretions, brainwaves, the whole shooting match affected by sound all the time. Psychologically, you just think of the impact of music on us, or voices, or all sorts of different sounds. So sound changes our feelings. Cognitive, sound changes how productive we are in thinking. And there are millions and millions of people around the world whose lives are being blighted by working in open plan offices where they can't think. An open plan may be good for collaboration, but it's absolute rubbish for concentrating, solo working, writing, and so forth. And the fourth way sound affects us is it changes our behavior. You know, there's a fantastic case study that illustrates this done a few years ago. Two supermarket gondola ends, one displaying French wine, one displaying German wine. And all they did was to change the music day after day. Day one, French music. Day two, German music. Day three, French music, and so on and on and on for weeks. What happened? Well, the French music day is French wine outsold German wine by 5 bottles to 1, which may not be surprising. They sell more in the world. But on the German music days, German wine outsold French wine by 2 bottles to 1. Now, that is a massive shift in purchasing behavior. And when people were asked, they hadn't even noticed the music. So this wasn't conscious, oh, German music there, therefore I should buy some German wine. It wasn't like that. It was a subconscious reaction to a not even noticed sound condition. And that is how much sound can change your behavior or mine. So, and then I thought, well, it's pretty important that we all start listening more carefully and reclaiming, getting back control, to use a hideous catchphrase, reclaiming our responsibility really for the sound that we make and the sound that we consume, understanding how important it is in our lives. So that also underpins the sound agency, and it became really the stuff I talked about in the later TED Talks, and then my book, How to Be Heard, was all about speaking and listening, personal sound. Because I realized after a while that organizations which make a lot of bad sound and don't listen very well, they do that because they're comprised of lots of people who make a lot of bad sound and don't listen very well. So it does come down to us all as individuals, really.
What's fascinating to me about you personally is you have the business, you have the ability to affect people on an individual and on a corporate level, but it strikes me that you're also trying to change humanity, that you're trying to raise the consciousness of human beings via the TED Talks and all of these things, because there's a campaigning element to this, is there not? You can help companies, but really it's about changing the human condition. Does that excite you more, that to affect change on a much more grander, wider scale?
That is the thing that excites me a lot, actually. I mean, it's one thing creating sonic logos for businesses. Actually, we do less of that now in the sound agency, and a lot more. It's about soundscaping environments. And very often that's about removing mindless music out of a shopping mall or a shop or some other place, particularly a corporate reception, and designing some sound that's actually appropriate and effective and valuable to the people in that space, which may not be music. It might be musical, it might be more natural sound, it might be something you've never heard before. But so we're much more into, it's kind of an art form, almost soundscaping, if you like. So yes, I think the whole emphasis of creating sound responsibly and designing it is very exciting. But you're right, underpinning it, I'm absolutely passionate about people becoming more conscious, about me becoming more conscious. And I find this work helps me to do that on a day-by-day basis. If we're listening more consciously, then we're living more fully. And that, to me, is a prize that's really worth reaching out for.
Are you an optimist? Do you think this is a battle, if I can frame it in that tabloid way, that you can win?
Well, I think there's some interesting things coming down the pipe. You know, I spoke earlier about technology being unstoppable. I mean, it is. But we're about to move into a different age of our relationship with particularly the internet and computers. You know, we've had decades now where they've taken hostage our fingers and our eyes. And so we're endlessly looking down at something and tapping. Well, that's about to change. And there is uncounted billions are being invested in speech recognition and voice synthesis. And so at the moment, we have these relatively dumb things we're talking to, whether it's Alexa or Siri or whatever it is. They are about to become much more intelligent because AI is about to move into those. And so we'll be able to have real conversations with things that are working out answers on the fly, intelligently, as opposed to just picking from a bunch of pre-designed responses. Now, that's going to change everything, because alongside that, we'll get wearable technology, things in our ears, or ultimately, I think probably things embedded in our skulls, which will be working through bone conduction. We will be speaking and listening to these devices far more than we're reading, writing, and typing. And that's going to bring back conversation. And, you know, the skills of speaking and listening will become important again to a large degree. I think it'll become much more natural again to start speaking to people instead of typing something to them or sending them a text. I hope so. So I do hope that this, which I think is, you know, this is all quite close. I'm talking within 10 years, all of this stuff, and probably within 5 for AI-based intelligent agents. I think that is going to be a bit of a cause for optimism, because the more we speak to people and listen, the less we're typing troll-like comments in comment sections under news pieces and so forth, the more directly connected we will be, and the more conscious we will be, and the more listening there'll be in the world. And that is the key to me. Listening is absolutely the key to our survival as a species, to our social survival. And you only have to look at the guy who's running Russia right now. And I mean, that's such a great case study. And what happens if you stop listening to people and you surround yourself with 3 or 4 people who all agree with everything you say? I mean, you go nuts. And that's what's happened. So I think, you know, listening is something that is so important. I'm so passionate about it. I hope very much that I'm making a small contribution to that here in the TED Talks, in the books and so forth. And I hope that there are ripples spreading in the pond, you know, 150 million people seeing those TED Talks does excite me, because I think in every one of those people, maybe they're changing their behavior a bit, and then they're affecting the people around them. And that's a lot of ripples and a lot of change, hopefully, happening in the world.
What's next for your campaign slash career, as it were? Where do you see things going over the next 5, 10, dare I say 20 years? You've got quite a lot of life left in you, and humanity is still not listening to one another. So there's a huge task there. What are the next steps that you're going to take along the way?
Yeah, well, I hope I've got a lot of life left in me. I'm 64 now, so I don't know how much of that technology I'm going to see down the pipe. But certainly, I happen to have an 18-month-old daughter now as well, and she will see a lot of it. So I care deeply about the future.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I think for me, the next thing is something I'm working on now, which I'm really excited about. Quercus Publishing, which is part of Hachette, has commissioned me to write a major book. It's going to be entitled Everything is Sound, and it's coming out in spring next year. I'm probably about 80% of the way through writing it, and I am adoring it. It's, you know, this is my passion, my life.
Presumably I can listen to the audiobook, not to undermine your own message.
You will be able to, yes. I recorded the How to Be Heard. We did the audiobook up here in a tiny little studio in Orkney, which normally has a couple of barons and a fiddle in it. And I was really excited, because doing it that way, we sent it off and they put it together, and then it won both of the world's top awards for best business audiobook of 2019, I think it was.
Wow, congratulations.
So that's in the audio. Yeah, that was amazing. So we're going to do a similar thing with this book. And obviously this book's all about sound, so there'll be lots of sounds interspersed. So I'm really excited about the audiobook version of this. So this is just a fantastic project. It's going to look at the sound of nature, the sound of the universe, the sound of humanity. It hopefully will engage people more and more in this amazing world of sound that's around us all the time and that we pay so little attention to. So yes, I've spoken to some amazing people, and it's just full of gobsmacking stuff. So that's my life for the bulk of this year. We'll be going through the edits and so forth. The sound agency is still producing lovely soundscapes in for businesses around the world. And I spend a fair bit of time still going around speaking to organizations about the importance of listening, how to become a listening organization, how to speak well. You know, these things, I think people are starting to rediscover the importance of speaking and listening skills in organizational life. They've been marginalized for a long time, largely by email and so forth. And death by PowerPoint and all that kind of thing. So I think now it is time for people to start listening to the importance of listening and speaking.
Have you had it where you've given a presentation to a group of people and someone isn't paying attention, they're on their phone at the back, or they're just there for sort of presenteeism. How do you have a toolkit of methodology, some strategy to command attention? I'm thinking of when I used to be at school and the supply teacher used to come. It wasn't about whether he or she was any good or worth listening to. It was that everyone just in the class thought it was an opportunity for mischief, and they'd almost lost before they'd walked through the door.
Yeah. Well, it depends on who they are. Again, you've got to be conscious of the listening you're speaking into. I have spoken in certain cultures. I've stood in the boardroom making, you know, an important business presentation to people of stuff they've paid for, and half of them have been looking at their hands and doing email. And that's their culture. There would have been no point in my challenging that. That's just sometimes the way you have to work. You can't change an entire culture in 5 minutes. However, if you're talking about a group of people, let's say in your business, and people are not paying attention, let's say you're presenting to the board, then there are polite ways to challenge that, like ask somebody a question. John, what do you think about this? Could you just say that again? You know, so that's a good way to engage people. I'm a big fan of having a kind of relationship with the whole room, as opposed to staring at one person. So it's about spreading your awareness of the whole room. And it's kind of like being in peripheral vision, you know, as opposed to being really focused on one person. And if you're in this kind of state of seeing the whole room at once, then you can generally see if somebody's not paying attention. And my approach would always be to engage that person. I mean, if you want to be more confrontational, you know, John, is there something I've said that you disagree with? Because you seem to be not with us at the moment. Depends on the authority balance between you and the people you're speaking to. Obviously, if they work for you, then you have more authority. If you're working for them or you're pitching to them, then a lot more politeness is due. But yeah, I mean, those are some ways of doing it. It's very important to be conscious of it and not just ignore it, because if you ignore it, these things can spread. You know, you get craters of disinterest, and it can spread to people around.
On your own personal learning journey, though, what have you learned of late on the, I mean, because there's so much scope here that you must be learning new things all the time. What have you learned recently?
The importance of listening in different situations, and the importance of different sounds in the world. I've been learning a huge amount about extraordinary sounds that I never knew about. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. There are some snapping shrimps which exist around the shorelines, particularly in parts of America, but all over the world. They're about as big as the final joint of your thumb, maybe even smaller. And they have a big claw, which they snap shut at such a speed that it creates a cavitation, a bubble, and it creates a sound that is around the noise of a rock concert if you were right next to it. Not only that, but there's a flash of light in the bubble, and that means that the temperature in there when they do this snapping of their claw must be about the same temperature as the surface of the sun. Now, I never knew that before. That's kind of mind-boggling that tiny little shrimps are able to make rock concerts and the surface of the sun temperatures at the same time. So learning things like that, learning that, you know, the old adage in space, no one can hear you scream from Alien. Well, it's not actually, well, that is true that we can't hear, but it's not true that there's no sound in space. There's plenty of sound in space, because space is not a vacuum. It's actually a very diffuse plasma, and very low frequency sounds, I'm talking about sounds which have got frequencies of years or centuries, huge long wavelengths, they can pass perfectly happily through this incredibly diffuse gas, because their wavelengths are so long. So there's lots of sound out there. There's sound from supernova, the sound of huge gas clouds moving about and clashing. There's the sounds of black holes and so forth, even gravitational waves coming from them, which we can pitch shift and listen to. So really, the universe, the world, the creatures around us, has this rich panoply of sound that it behooves us to pay more attention to. You know, it's so sad that we lock ourselves into cities and all we can hear is traffic noise when there's this incredible richness out there, and it's worth paying attention to it.
Julian, it's been worth paying attention to you on this podcast. I've enjoyed listening to it immensely and I've learnt a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, wasn't that amazing? It was created and produced by Podcast Partners. They're really lovely people and rather good at all this podcasting guff. Find out more at podcastpartners.com.